Hi, welcome back to Mixed Identity, the podcast where I interview people who have more than one identity. So starting out, this is really multiracial or multi-ethnic, but we're keeping it open to look at all things. We're also going to be changing up I am going to be changing up the format a little. I've gotten some great feedback from listeners, and I'm going to be starting off with responding to listener comments. So, this comment comes from my cousin, who is on my McKinney side, which is my white Iowa farmer side, and she is lovely, but she also happens to be married to a mixed race man who is mixed of both black and white. And we were talking, and them listening to this podcast has sparked some conversations with them. They have two beautiful mixed race children, and they're just really talking about this. And one of the things that my cousin said was that she feels like it might be common to reject whiteness of your ethnicity because it is a dominant culture. And she puts a question mark in there. She texted this to me. And she's really interested for me to interview someone who is mixed from two minority cultures, which I'm working on that. I'm working on getting some more guests. And if you are interested in being guests, whatever your mix is, I'd love to talk to you too. But while thinking on this rejecting whiteness, I also listened to a podcast called No Small Thing, and their latest episode that I listened to was on gender. And the host of this podcast had recently come out as genderqueer, and the episode was really her talking about her journey of finding this part of her identity, this understanding, though, even though she tried on the really feminine parts of being a woman and a girl throughout her life, it never felt comfortable. But she also never felt comfortable being a man. And when she finally came to a point in an understanding that she could identify as something that was not binary, not male or female, man or woman, that she was able to find a lot of comfort in that. And it made me start to really think that how I identify right now, I say I am a Simpson woman. I don't regularly acknowledge my white ethnicity when I'm talking. I mean, that is what people see for the most part when they look at me, but I don't acknowledge it. But that is not my understanding of my identity has been a journey, just like Macy's on No Small Thing. So for her gender identity, my multiracial identity, my mixed identity has been a journey. And I wanted to share a story about a period of years where I really packed away my Simpson identity because of a certain thing that happened to me and to other members of my family. And just to show you that even though it's always moving, I think for all of us, and having just an hour of conversation with people of mixed identity doesn't cover it. And we all have these long journeys, and we're at one point in these journeys in all of our lives. So this story about the time I was given a name when I was a young woman. So in junior high or high school, I was given a child's name by my Uncle Russell. It is Ama Gyatan Tuwalsh, and it means very kind princess or very kind child of the higher up. But there are certain protocols in the Simpson culture that you have to follow to make your name official. And so this means that you have to have either at a potlatch or have a big event where you gift, you give away gifts, and you have to follow certain protocols. And so after receiving my name as a young person, 20 years later, I was able to, almost 20 years later, I was able to get back to Metlakatla for the Gunhata potlatch. And at this time, I had worked with my uncle and a very esteemed gentleman of the community to understand this protocol. And so fast forward to the potlatch we had done, and it was me and my sister and my aunt. We were all receiving our names along with some other members of the community. And We are for my, since we were all Ganjada, my aunt, my sister and I, we went together, and we followed a protocol that we were taught by this esteemed gentleman of the community. This protocol is something that we've been relearning because our culture has been taken from us. So we followed it and it went one way, and it was, okay, but what made it, and it was correct, the protocol was correct, but what made it really hurtful is that this other group of people who were more in this esteemed gentleman's in-crowd went, and the whole performance of these protocols and everything was done at a different level. And it was made very clear to my sister and my aunt and I that we were second-tier Simpsons, and I was so frustrated and hurt by this that I actually left the potlatch and I went to the shore and I just sat on a big log and cried, and my spouse came out and sat with me, and I didn't talk to that uncle. I tried to connect with him and talk to him about what happened and those things. And he didn't respond to me for years. And I went back to my life and I packed away all my Simpsonness because I felt that I felt that this esteemed gentleman, had put ownership on our culture, and because he had done so much for our ways that he was basically deeming me to be not Simpson enough, that I wasn't going to participate anymore. And it took me years. This happened when I was first married, and I didn't start to reengage with Simpson culture until my son was born. And even then, I couldn't. My anxiety was so high when I started to try to go start dancing with Simpson Hayuk, because this gentleman's presence is everywhere in Simpson culture. I was worried about how I would be perceived there, and that I wasn't Indian enough, that I wasn't Simpson enough, that I didn't belong to these groups. And it took me a long time to realize that this man has no ownership. No one has ownership over this culture except of all Simpsons. We all have ownership over it. It cannot reside in one person. There is nothing like that. And so even though I spent about 4 years of my life rejecting my Simpson identity and really living in my white identity, it took me time to get back. And I can think of many times, and maybe I'll share this with you, share more stories with you during this feedback time. But it's a journey. So even though it might seem that my brothers and sisters, if you've listened to the episodes, might be rejecting whiteness at this time, I think we've all gone through journeys where we've been more accepting of our whiteness or more accepting of our Simpsonness, and it's always moving. And that's part of being mixed. There is no definition of who you are, and we're all different. Every mixed story is different. And that's why I'm doing this podcast. So again, this is the feedback portion. And to keep this going, I'd love for you to give feedback. And I know you are not all my cousin and can text message me, and I'm not giving out my phone number. But you can go to our Facebook side, which you can find us at Identity Mixed, or you can just search Mixed Identity and the page should come up. So you can respond on the episode postings there. I also post in Instagram at Identity_mixed, and you can keep the conversation going there. I do check. I do love to respond. And so I hope that you will help me continue this conversation, because I do think it's important as we all talk and discover our journeys and share our journeys with you. It'll bring up thoughts for all of us. So I'd like to thank my cousin for really sparking dialogue with me and with her husband. I think that's exciting, and I hope to keep going. So we're going to take a quick ad break, and we're going to come back for what is my favorite episode so far, an interview, and that's with my own mother, Sandra Beale McKinney. So stay tuned. Thanks. We're taping a little out of order. I still got to get my brother Ken in but he's having some
moving issues.
Yeah. And that voice you heard was my mother, Sandra McKinney Beal. And that's who we will talk to today. But let me just remind you of what Mixed Identity is. It's a podcast where I, your host, Heather Puri, interview people who have mixed identities. So right now, I'm starting with my family. And so I like to say that my mom is the OG, original gangster of mixed race. Because she was mixed race before
there was the mixed race.
I know. So, I mean, when were your parents married?
1951.
Yeah. So in a lot of states, their marriage was not legal.
I'm sure.
Yeah. You know, Dad was shocked when I told him that, like, very close to when you were married, that you and him in certain states weren't allowed to be married. We were talking about gay marriage, and I said, you realize, right, that you and mom in some states, because loving
southern states.
I'm southern sure. states,
thank
yes.
You. Thank you.
Well, yes. Virginia. Wow. Virginia. That's... Loving versus Virginia is a court case that made it legal. And that was only in 1960 something. So when were you and Dad married?
1973.
So, like, if
years
you.
Years before.
You would have been three when you got married. You would have been three.
What the heck, I was four when I had you.
So. Yes. So we have my mom here. I'm going to let her introduce herself a little, and you can just introduce yourself. She's my mom of six awesome kids. I think they're awesome.
Off and on, they're all awesome.
Yes. and you can introduce yourself a little, and the question I like to start with is, how do you identify yourself?
Oh, that's easy. I identify as a Tsimshian woman. I was born in Alaska of Paul and Dorothy McKinney. My mom was full-blooded Indian or FBI. My dad was a very Caucasian white guy farmer from Iowa. And how they met was even a good story, but we don't really, you want
you
me to go
share
into that?
That, yeah.
Okay, well, my mom, that ringer is only on because Rehan wanted the noise for the game.
It's fine.
Okay.
It happened in my first episode, too.
Okay. My dad had been married. He had a son who's my half-brother, Rex, who's still living. He's 82 years old now. And my dad was farming in Iowa, married a woman there named Gladys. And she was accidentally shot and killed in a shooting accident because a neighbor had left a loaded rifle out where young children could get at it. It was picked up by a child. She was shot and killed. So my dad was widower at, you know, a fairly young age with a fairly young son. Rex, if I'm guessing, was maybe somewhere between 8 and 10. And Dad was very active in his church. They went to a Methodist church there in Iowa. And he wasn't doing well. My brother wasn't doing well. And his pastor recommended that he get out of Iowa. And his pastor at the time was a woman, which was very unusual, which would have been in the late 1940s, real early 1950s. His pastor was a woman, and she recommended that he get out of town. In fact, she got out of the state because it wasn't good for him or my brother. And she found him a job at an orphanage, kind of being an all-around handyman in Seward, Alaska. And so he packed his bags, went with my brother to Seward, Alaska. He drove a school bus. He made sure the school bus kept running. He did any little odd jobs they needed done at this orphanage. Well, around the same time, my mom married a man who was a Tlingit. My mom was a Tsimshian. She married a Tlingit, and for whatever reason, the marriage didn't work. So in the late 1940s, my mom got a divorce, which was also very unheard of in the 1940s. And she was living in Metlakatla, actually taking care of her mother. Her father had already died. Her mother was living. Grandma stayed in Metlakatla and cared for her mother as she aged. And when my grandmother died, my mom's minister, who was affiliated with the Methodist Church, said, "Dorothy, you and Jenny need to get out of here. This is not
a good..." And Jenny's your sister.
My older sister, yes. And both my mom's minister said, "Dorothy, you need to get out of here. There is nothing here for you. I found this job. It's at an orphanage. They need like a house mother who would stay in a house with these children who had been orphaned." And they were mostly Native kids. And so off my mom gets shipped to Seward, Alaska. And my older sister, Jenny, was, I believe at the time, 3 years old. And she didn't have a dad. And she really wanted a dad. And she met the man who my mom would marry and who would become my dad, Paul, at this orphanage. And Jenny liked him so much. She followed him around, mom said, like a little puppy. She picked out her own dad. And mom said, my mom said, she was so embarrassed because Aunt Jen just followed this strange man all around the place because she wasn't in school, but she just loved my dad. And he loved her right back. And that's how my mom and dad started talking and seeing each other. And then they eventually married. They stayed working at this orphanage, but mom wanted to move back to Metlakatla. And she told dad, she said, "Well, Paul, if we move to Metlakatla, the electricity is free in town for everyone." And so so he said, "Well, that sounds like a good deal." So they move back to Metlakatla, and within a few years, they start charging for electricity. But my mom got home, so she was happy.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that's how an Iowa farmer from the middle of nowhere, Podunk, Iowa, practically, it was actually Afton,
which
Iowa.
Is, I've been there. It's the middle of nowhere.
There really is a Podunk, Iowa.
Yeah, there's nothing there.
And my mom from a little island village in Metlakatla, Alaska.
Podunk, Alaska.
Yeah, met each other in Seward, got married. She said it was a very quiet marriage, just witnesses and the minister who married him. And they eventually had me, so I was their first daughter, and they had my younger sister, Ruth.
Yeah.
So mom ended up having three daughters and a son. I think she really wanted a boy with me, so I was kind of treated a little differently, mm-hmm. you know, because I think mom really wanted to have a son, and it was supposed to be me, but it didn't happen. But I was always a little more rough and tumble than my younger sister, who was very shy and very quiet and very low-key.
So we'll get back to that. And the next question I want to ask, and I think you have a lot of different, you've gone through this because you've lived all over the world.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear what the world has identified you as, because most people don't know what Simpsons even are.
Well,
right?
they have no idea. They know when they look at me that I'm something.
Yeah.
That I'm not Caucasian, that I am not a white female.
Yeah.
But they also look at me and I'm brown, but they don't hear any Spanish accent in the background. And I've had people, usually, typically, older Caucasian women who ask me, finally, after they've known me for a year or two, "What are you?" And I will tell them, "I'm a native of Alaska. I'm Tsimshian." And like Heather said, people don't usually recognize that name. And I said, "Do you know the people with the totem poles?" I said, yeah. "It's the people with the totem poles in that part of the world from like Seattle." It's, you know, it starts a little lower than Seattle,
yeah.
but Seattle up to, you know, halfway up the panhandle.
Yeah.
So is pretty much where the Tsimshians, the Tlingits, and the Haidas live.
Yeah.
And they're the ones with the totem poles. So that's how I usually tell people what I am. The yeah. people with the totem poles.
The people with the totem poles. So I'd like to talk. You were a teacher for many, mm-hmm. many years. So I'd like to talk. So when you taught in this podcast, if you've listened, listeners, you know about my sister and I have talked about Pomona and kind of the makeup of that. And it was predominantly Black or Hispanic. And you taught at a junior high school in that area and then at the high school as well that Ruth yes. and I attended. Can you talk about your interaction with the kids there, which I always found interesting?
Yes. Well, I started teaching at John Marshall Middle School. I think Heather probably at the time was in first or second grade. Mm-hmm. And I started my teaching career actually at this junior high in Pomona. And really the makeup of the school, it had at one time been mostly Black, but it was funny as the lighter brown, as the Spanish speakers moved in, the Black people moved further east in the valley. So when I was there, it was really mostly Spanish speakers. In fact, I taught a couple of my classes were called English as a Second Language. So I was teaching people who their first language was Spanish mostly. There were also some who were Vietnamese. So I had to be able to teach them in English, because California passed a law that you could no longer teach them in their native tongue. I had to teach them in English, but I had to learn multiple ways of saying the same thing, teaching the same concept. And the Spanish speakers looked at me and they thought I looked like I was a native Spanish speaker, and they would speak to me in Spanish, not during class, well, sometimes during class, but between classes. And they would get very upset when I would tell them I don't speak Spanish. And they said, "What? Why don't you speak Spanish?" And were totally offended. And I said, "Well, I don't speak Spanish because I'm a native of Alaska and they don't speak Spanish in Alaska as their native tongue." So then they would go even further and they say, "Well, do you speak your native tongue?" And I'd say, "No, I don't, but let me tell you why." I said, "My mom started school, first grade, and she did not speak a word of English. And she, you know, went to school locally for grades 1 through 8. But she could only speak Tsimshian or Chamalgyak, and she was not allowed to speak her native tongue in school. And if she did, she would have her mouth washed out with soap." And she said, "And Sandy, it wasn't soft ivory soap." She said, "It was lye soap that burnt your mouth." Oh. And my students would go, "Oh." You know, because a lot of them started school at whatever age, you know, they started in the U.S. not speaking English. And they realized that they really had it a lot easier than people who had been there 50 or 60 years earlier.
Yeah.
And as a result, I would ask permission of my principal at whatever school I was teaching at, that I would bring in things from Alaska, from my native culture, and I would have a cultural day. And I would spend that whole day with my, you know, 6 periods of students teaching them about my culture. And then we'd have cultural days where they could tell me about theirs. And
it was, which is, you had to ask permission because you taught
yes.
math, not
yeah,
history.
I was a math teacher. I had to ask permission because... we were told you couldn't have parties. You weren't allowed to have parties, but you could have a cultural day. And it was fun because my students, although most of them were brown, they weren't all Spanish speakers. There were some that were Puerto Rican. There were some who were Asian. And there were some, let me see, where else were they from? Well, Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And boy, we would get some of the best food.
Man.
And one
Filipino food, yeah.
Yeah, it was Filipino, and they brought in like a flan. It was a caramel flan. And oh my gosh. Someone brought it in the first time, and I jokingly said the next time, "Whoever brings in a flan with that caramel sauce on top gets an A next semester." But they didn't. I could have gotten in trouble for that.
So that was, in your teaching career, very positive experiences mm-hmm. with students. I'd like to talk a little about, and we can choose, I know, I'm sorry, but I think it's important for our listeners to understand that what has happened. So I will let you choose to either talk about your experience in San Clemente, which is a very rich, white, rich, white place, or most recently, when you were teaching at the high school in Mesa and you had that horrible student. So you can choose. I'll let you choose, but I want them to understand that, like, there were some very positive things about
being... It was the sad thing is, actually, it's not sad, it's a good thing. When I was teaching kids who were mostly brown, I've got a tickle in my throat.
Heather. Yeah, you can drink. You can do it. So I'll just vamp for a little bit. My mom has taught in a number of areas. So one, she started in Pomona, and then she taught in San Clemente, California, which was, if you've seen Orange County, or what is that, or Housewives of Orange County, that the Real Housewives, that is San Clemente.
It wasn't quite that wealthy.
There were parts of it. We just didn't live in that part of it. But it still existed, and you had students who lived in those parts and had parents like that.
God.
So we could talk about that, which was a very hard experience for you. And I know in Arizona, in Mesa, at the high school.
Skyline.
You had a very, harassment.
It was a very white area of Mesa. Very few native Spanish speakers, very few people of color total.
But lower income.
Very much lower income. It was like the ghetto of Mesa.
The white ghetto, yeah.
Yes. Guess I'll talk about that since we kind of started. So I got a job because I wanted to go on a trip. And I wanted to go to Africa on safari because we had friends going there for 2 years. So I said to my husband, if I get a job...
They know about missions.
So it was a mission. It was a mission. It was neighbors of ours. He's a orthopedic surgeon and she's a surgical nurse. So they were going there and serving a medical mission for about 2 years. And when I heard they were going to South Africa, I went, oh, that's been my dream trip since I was probably 5 years old, leafing through my dad's National Geographics. So I said to my husband, hey, Joe, if I get a job teaching next year and I pay our insurance and I save up all my money, can we go to South Africa and visit the heaps? And he said, sure, but you don't have to get a job. And I said, oh, I kind of felt like, you know, it was my dream. So I got a teaching job and it was in Far East Mesa, Skyline High School. I hope none of those kids hear this. Trailer park city, you know.
There were lots of trailer parks. Yes. It was a very low income area. Way that Pomona was low income, but it just happened to be low
brown people.
This was low income
white people. And I happened to share with one of my students something about being from Alaska. Because he thought I was brown enough that I should speak Spanish also.
Yeah.
And he was one of the few of the students who was brown. And he said, do you speak Spanish? And I said, no, I'm from Alaska. And he said, oh, are you an Eskimo? I said, no, not everyone from Alaska is an Eskimo. And by the way, they're called Inuits.
Yes.
And they're much further north in Alaska than where I'm from. Where I'm from is more like Seattle, lots of rain, lots of water, real green. And he took that information and he thought it was pretty cool. But the other students in the class took that information and started walking by my classroom every morning before school. Now realize this was in the the early 2000s. And
post 9/11.
Post 9/11, you know, there was real security at the school systems. And so I would go in early every morning and have time. I would let my students know I would be there half an hour every morning before school started if they needed some help, if they were having problems with any specific, you know, areas of math, I would be there for half an hour before school. And the school policy was that if you were in your classroom and a student came in, you have to have the door open. So I wanted my students to know I was there for them, so I kept my door open. Well, this group of young men, and there were about four or five of them, two or three of them who were my students, would walk by my classroom every day and call me an Eskimo. And I kind of didn't know what to do about it. And then I realized they were all standing outside watching for me to get to school. And, you know, I wasn't afraid. I wasn't worried. I didn't think they were going to hurt me in any way, but they were harassing. And so I stopped out there and I spoke with this group of young men. And I said, hey, guys, that's really not very funny. I know you think you're being funny, but it's not. And I asked them if they would please stop. I asked them very politely to please stop. And they didn't.
It escalated.
Yes, it escalated. It got worse. And I'm not the one to run to my boss first thing and complain. Uh-huh. You know, my way is to take care of it on my own. But I did eventually go to the vice principal, who's in charge of discipline. Uh-huh. And I went by his office and talked to his secretary, told her what was going on, and asked if I could please have an appointment to talk to the vice principal. Well, she never did anything about it. She never did anything about it.
Could I ask the race of the woman? No.
Just about everyone at the school, all of the other teachers, except the Spanish teacher, were all white.
All right.
And I happened to mention it to my husband. You know, this is after it's been going on for 3 months.
It was really hard on you. I was living in Arizona at the time.
It was very hard.
It was stressful. It was making you sick.
Getting up and going to work every morning, which every teaching position I'd had in the past, I love. Well, no, not Santa Monica, San Clemente either. Yeah. But, it was hard for me because I really cared for my students. I love teaching math. And to have this happen was causing me stress. And my younger sister, Ruth, at the time was a reporter in San Diego. And I phoned her because her and I would talk and we'd visit all the time. And I told her what was going on. And she goes, oh my gosh, Sandy, that's harassment. You've got to get that stopped. So I went back to the vice principal's office again. And I said, I really need an appointment with the vice principal and I need to have it as soon as possible. Because it just so happened that my husband and I, through church, knew the superintendent of schools in Mesa. Mm-hmm. Dad and he had worked in a church calling together. They were on the high council together. Mm-hmm. So they knew each other quite well. So eventually, my husband, after 3 or 4 months of this going on and me not getting any help at school, he went to the superintendent of the schools of Mesa and said, hey, you know, my wife's getting harassed at school. And he said, oh, really? What's going on? And Dad told him, and he immediately sent his person who handles discipline in the schools out to the high school. And by then, I'm panicking. I'm going, you have to let me talk to the vice principal right now.
Yeah.
I said, you don't understand. My husband phoned the superintendent of Mesa Schools, and he is sending someone out here. And they finally let me talk to the vice principal. But by then, the guy from the superintendent's office had already come out and reamed him because they hadn't taken care of the problem when it first started months earlier. The students were expelled for a number of days, which then got some of the other students really angry because they were brothers and sisters of the students who got expelled. And so then I had to pay that price with my other students, but it kind of went away.
Yeah.
And it was okay. One of my students got transferred to another teacher's class, and he said, I don't care, she's a better math teacher than you are anyway. Well, and she was actually in her second year of teaching. She was very nice, but she wasn't a better math teacher than I was. Yeah.
So I'm going to move on to something I think that is funner, but I'd like to talk to you about when you were in high school in Northern California and you met Dad. I guess you met in sixth grade.
Yes.
But I know Dad has told me that he thought you were Japanese.
Yes.
And so I don't know if you want to talk about that and that kind of experience.
Yeah, we were growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I moved there when I was 11 from Alaska. And my husband and I started going to the same school together in the sixth grade. And then we really got to be friends in band when we were in seventh and eighth grade. And then when we hit high school. Most of my friends at the time were Japanese. So my husband, who had met my mother, this is why it didn't fit, right? He had met my mother, he didn't know my dad, but my last name was McKinney. Now, he met my mom, she didn't look very Japanese to me, you know?
Yeah.
But he thought I was half Japanese and half white because all my friends were Japanese, so he figured that's what I was. And I said, how could I be? You met my mom. She's way too brown to be Japanese.
Yeah.
And my last name was McKinney. That's no more a Japanese last name than Beale is. And I just kind of laughed. He thought I was Japanese, half Japanese, because my friends were all Japanese. Yeah. So
you've lived all over the world with Dad traveling with the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to talk about your experience living in South Korea? Because I think that would be an interesting time, and I know nothing really about you living there and how people perceived you there, because you didn't live on base, right?
No. Well, anytime we lived anywhere out of the country, Dad didn't have enough rank at the time, or he didn't have a command-sponsored tour, so we couldn't get on-base housing. But in Korea, Dad flew over, the military flew him over, and he found an apartment, and then he came back taking military hops, which took him about a week to get home, and then it took us another week and a half to get back.
And that just means that you get on a plane that you can't get on,
That's free.
Pretty going free. Wherever
yeah.
it is, and hope you somehow
get to Korea, South Korea, where you want to be.
Yeah.
So we ended up on that tour. We ended up in Hawaii for a week, which for most people would sound heavenly, but remember, my husband was in the Army and his pay was very low. So we spent, and we had a six-week-old baby. Ruth was 6 weeks old at the time.
I can't believe you traveled with a six-week-old baby. And two other ones.
A four-year-old and a two-year-old.
Which I have a four-year-old and two-year-old right now, and I've been on a 14-hour flight with them, and I would not add a six-week-old to that mix. I have three other adults to help me, too.
I know. My younger daughter is a wuss. What can I say?
Oh, man. Or you're super tough. All right. So you got to South Korea.
South Korea.
You'd interact. You'd have to go to the market. And you would...
Yeah. We didn't have commissary privileges. Dad could spend $150 a month at the commissary. But I couldn't go. And that was because they had such a big black market in Korea. If the soldiers could go in and buy anything they wanted, they couldn't keep it stocked for the people who were there for longer tours and had commissary rights. So Dad would ride the bus in because we didn't have a car. I think my husband and I were probably in the best shape in our lives. We didn't have a car. We had three kids we had to provide food for. The one thing we did have that made life with a third child easy was we had a house girl, because the apartments didn't come with washers or dryers, neither were there any available anywhere within walking distance. So we hired a house girl who I think probably cost us $35 a month, some outrageously low amount. And she would come in the morning and she would do the laundry. Mostly what we were paying her for was do the laundry. But she would stay from like 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. So I could put the kids down for a nap and then I could walk to the little military base, to the library, and check out books, which, you know, is one of my favorite things to do is read. But we would have to, I'd have to walk to the closest military base twice a day because they'd only let me buy 2 quarts of milk at a time. And that wasn't enough for a nursing mother and 2 young children. So I would walk and it was a mile there and a mile back. And I'd do that twice a day to get enough milk for the kids and me. But it was interesting. There was a song on what was it called? What did you guys used to watch? Sesame Street. And it was called Fish Heads. Now, my mom, being a full-blooded Indian from Alaska, she would, I mean, pretty much they ate the whole fish.
Yeah, you know? Eyes were.
Yeah, the eyes were like a delicacy. And my mother would
fight for them.
Yeah, and she wouldn't fight for them because we didn't want them. But she would, when she would get, one of her siblings would send her or bring her fish heads, she would just relish them.
Yeah.
And she would cook them and she'd eat them and she'd pop the eyeballs and go on and on. This is so good. And my sister and I were totally freaking out over her doing that. But in Korea, they really had dried fish. I mean, dry, like crack, like a little stick. And I wish there was some way I could have brought that home for her so she could really see dried fish. But they wouldn't let us bring it home, so I couldn't do it.
So I'm just thinking, we have a cousin, Uncle David's daughter was in South Korea. And when she was there, they insisted that she must be Korean. Like they.
That's so true.
I was wondering with you, what did the Koreans think you were?
The Koreans never asked me. They might have thought I was Amerasian, but it never came up because I was obviously a native English speaker, so it never came up. But Ken, our oldest son, he would play down on the street, you know, and there was no, we had no grass for them to play on. It was just, you know, dirt in front of our apartment on a decently quiet street, and he would go down there and play. And I could peek out the window because we were on the 3rd floor and I would peek out to make sure the kids were okay because it would be Briny and Kenny who would be playing down there with the other neighbor kids. And but Ken definitely looked like he could have been Amerasian. And Amerasians were not looked upon highly. They were looked upon the same as half-breeds are in Alaska, not very highly, which is what I am, by the way.
Yeah.
So I never worried that anyone would steal Kenny because no one wanted half Asian, half white kid.
So do you want to talk a little bit about that too, about Auntie Ethel and, that story? I've heard a lot, but I think it's a good one to share.
It's, from the time I started school, there would be kids at school who would tell me that it varied from, you think you're better than us because you're half white, to being, you're horrible because you're only half Tsimshian. And, you know, I got told that from probably my birth, and I only remember kindergarten on. And I came home from school one time, I was probably in the 3rd or 4th grade, and I came home from school and I was so upset because there were a bunch of kids telling me I was half white and I was half Indian. And I came home to my mom and dad and I said, why do they keep telling me I'm half white and I'm half Indian? Which half? Is the top half white and the bottom half Indian? Or am I split right down the middle? And I was just so irate as this fairly young child. I could see my parents doing all they could not to laugh at me because I was so upset that I was considered, the kids, when they were rude, would call me a half-breed. And there was one time later in life when my aunt, my mom's oldest sister, and actually my favorite aunt's, and dare I say I was her favorite niece until our oldest daughter came along, and I just felt like she didn't love me anymore, and I felt just horrible because I felt probably like all my cousins had felt when they were growing up, because Auntie Ethel loves me the most.
Yeah.
And she came, she would come to visit us because we were in Fort Lewis in Washington for a number of years, long enough to have three children born there, by the way. And Heather,
that's me.
Yeah, Heather was Heather was born there. Paul was born there. Yeah. Ruth, we're all born there.
Yeah.
And then Auntie Ethel would come down and visit every summer for a month. And she told me she could only be there for a month because they had a permanent fund, and you couldn't leave more than 30 days or you wouldn't get the permanent fund. So she would never, she counted the 30 days exactly. But one time she started going off on how all these half-breeds were moving back to Alaska so they could get the permanent fund, and how she thought it was just horrible that they were allowed to do this. And I let her go on for a while, realized she's still my favorite aunt and I'm still her favorite niece. And she loves my children the most, which she did. You know, there was no doubt she did. And she was ranting and raving. And I finally said to her, I said, Auntie Ethel, you're talking about me. I'm a half-breed. And she stopped and she realized, yes, she was talking about me, and she stopped. And she never did it again. But she just had known me since birth. She had loved me and cared for me. She was my babysitter. She never had children of her own. She would be the one who would tell me Tsimshian stories for my bedtime stories, just from her memory. I mean, and she did not identify at all when she was ranting about these half-breeds that I was one of them.
Yeah,
because she loved me and she didn't identify me as a half-breed, although I was.
Yeah.
And it, I think it surprised her when she realized.
When she made that connection.
Yes, yes.
I like something else, I just be for myself. I would love to know what it was like when you first left the reservation and moved to Northern California. I mean, San Mateo, which is, even then was a big city outside of San Francisco.
Oh,
and you were 11 years old and you're leaving this. The only place you've ever known is a tiny little island.
With all of my cousins within walking distance.
Yeah. Yes. And nobody, everybody leaves their keys in the car. Like, nobody
had
their
cars.
Oh, nobody had cars.
At the time, they had dirt roads and hardly anyone had cars.
All right. See, these are things I don't know. Yeah. So, like, can you talk a little bit about that experience
move?
And moving to a place that
was a city.
A city and diverse, but segregated.
Very much segregated.
Like there was the Asian part and there was the black part and there was the white part.
And where we moved to was the white part.
Well, your dad was white.
And my dad was white, but my mom wasn't.
I know. I don't know.
I didn't. I guess mom was okay. I don't, you know. I know I was okay with it. I really, really missed Auntie Ethel. We were allowed to, because back then there were no cell phones, long distance phone calls were very
really
expensive. And we were allowed to talk to family in Alaska once a month. And that's when I would be able to talk to Auntie Ethel. And I would take the phone out. There was a kitchen door that went right out to the garage with two little stairs going down. And I would sit there and I would talk to Auntie Ethel and I would just cry because she was the one I missed.
Mm-hmm.
I was okay without my cousins. I was okay without everyone else. But Auntie Ethel had been such a big part of my life that I just ached for missing her. And my younger sister, Ruth, she was... How old were you when we moved from Utah to California?
Six.
So Auntie Ruth was 7 when we moved from Alaska to California. And again... I mean, we went, when the school we went to had one kindergarten class, one first grade class, one second grade class. And you, if you had cousins your age, you went to school with them all through high school. Her very best friend was Bobby, Aunt Bobby.
Oh, yeah.
And Harriet, who was Aunt Bobby's cousin on the Brendable side, they were like these three little buddies that were always together at someone's house or the other playing. And we moved to California. My sister, my younger sister, was darker complected than I was. Yep. I, of the mom's three daughters, I was the fairest. And so I kind of fit in California. By then there were a few brown people around, so yeah. I kind of fit in. But Ruth didn't feel like she fit in at all. And she hated going to school. So I spent my entire sixth grade year. Fortunately, the school was small enough, we all had lunch together. After we ate lunch, I would have to spend my lunch recess with my younger sister. And we'd just walk around the playground together and visit and talk, because she couldn't sleep, she couldn't Aww. Eat, she just was so lonesome for the only place she had ever lived.
And so different. I know
yes.
Utah, I mean, you moving from Utah to California was hard on me at mm-hmm. that age. I lied a lot to try to tell you I was sick. but yeah, you can only imagine going from a place with dirt roads and...
Yeah, to asphalt. I mean, my Uncle Joe, who was my mom's youngest brother, he said, oh, you're moving to California? When you're on the freeway, don't put your arm out of the car. It'll get ripped off. And I believed him, you know. He was also the same uncle who told me if you got new shoes, if you spit on them and rub it in, the shoes would last longer.
He sounds like a great
and
uncle.
Mom said years later, she said, do you know how much your uncle loved telling you those things? And then he...
Is this the one that you say Junior looks a lot like?
Yes, Junior, yeah. Junior Nathan.
Our dance.
Yeah, looks a lot like my Uncle Joe.
Yeah.
Their height, he's actually a little taller than Uncle Joe was. Their height, their body build, the way they look,
well,
you know, and they're descended from, you know, they're Haywards. Yeah.
Yeah.
And but he would tell me all these things, and of course I'd believe him. And he would also, Auntie Ethel would come visit for a month every summer to California while we were there. And Auntie B would come. She came one time with her kids, and I remember we all drove and went to Disneyland. But Uncle Joe worked the traps in Alaska, which aren't even in use anymore, but it was a way of catching salmon. And it was very isolated because the trap would be set out somewhere, you know, in open water, and just have a little hut on there, and he'd have his radio so he could listen to his sports. But it was very quiet. He'd have magazines, he'd have the newspaper. Someone would come out once a week, you know, or a couple times a week and take the fish and bring them into the cannery. But my uncle spent 3 or 4 months every summer working the traps. And he got paid very, very well for it. But he also drank. And if he finished his work on the traps and then he came into town, he and his buddies would drink up all his money, and then he wouldn't have enough left for the winter to get through the year.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So my oldest aunt talked to my mom, who was, you know, one of the middle daughters, and he would come down and spend the winters with us in California, because that way his buddies wouldn't get him to buy
drinking
all their
too much.
Alcohol,
yeah.
You know. Because he earned more money, because working the traps earned more money than
whatever
other things
it was
they could
doing.
Do. Yeah.
All right. So we're going up about on the time that I allow. And so thank you. But I'd like to end with one question, and I'll go first with mine. But what right now would you like to suggest? It could be food. It could be a book. It could be anything that you're doing.
Suggest?
Yeah.
Anything?
Like kind of a suggestion to the listener of just something that's great. So I'll share mine and you can think about it for a little. So mine, and I've made you watch this, is Molly of Denali,
mm-hmm.
PBS Kids. And this just goes, it just makes me so excited. It's the first television show ever to have an Alaska Native as its main character. And it just makes me really happy because watching it, actually the first episode I cried because they take some really tough subjects. Like you talked about, you didn't talk about how Grandma a little bit went to boarding school.
Yeah.
And how she had her mouth washed out with soap and those kind of things. So they take that subject in a way that 3 to 8 year olds can digest it, yeah. But tell stories that most people have no knowledge of, but are my history. So being able to see someone who's kind of like me, again, we got all other stuff mixed in, but having Alaska Natives, which are different from lower 48 Natives, and just that, it just makes me really excited. And I think about representation, and most recently, a second one I'm going to put in is Bial Cook's Doll. It's a book, that I've read to my son, and it's about a little East Indian, as my dad says, or from India, boy cooking doll for his friends, and it's different from what they taste, and it's really good. And the boy looks like Rihan, and we read it, and then he went to school, and he's like, "We have that book at my house school," and so for him to see people who eat the food he eats that look like him, that are like him, like representation in places matter. And I didn't realize how much it mattered to me until I watched Molly of Denali, because I've never had representation in media ever. And I was like, oh, this is cool. But I cried because I didn't realize how much that meant to me. In the same way, like when Barack Obama was elected president, yes. Because he's a mixed race dude, I was like, I will admit, I didn't vote for him the first time. I didn't vote for whoever he was running against either. I voted for some weird candidate, I'm sure. But I cried because a mixed race dude was in the White House, right? Yeah. So it was just like, wow, if a mixed race guy can do that, like, that's just awesome. The mixed race story isn't there, which is why I'm doing this podcast. So there's more people who hear these stories. Hopefully more, I'll promote this and more people will listen. But what would you suggest or that you love? It could be, I just went to this bakery in Bellevue and got delicious gluten-free cupcakes for
my daughter. Just became gluten intolerant.
I didn't become, but I just realized.
Yeah, just realized it.
Oh, it is. It's depressing.
What would I recommend?
It could be a book that you're reading, a show you're watching.
This is better than that.
Okay.
I would recommend having grandchildren.
All right.
They are the most wonderful little people in the world, and they stay that way even when they get older. Jenny is 16 and getting ready to graduate from high school. She's still as wonderful as she was when she was 1 year old, you know, and 2 years old and sharing her popsicle with Max. And it was just the sweetest thing because she'd suck on her popsicle and Max would jump at her feet, my little dog, and she'd hold her popsicle down and let him have some licks and she'd take it back and keep eating it. I mean, you know, to going today to a bookstore and reading some books there with Rihan and watching him at swimming lessons. The sad thing is you have to go through having children yourself to be a grandmother, to earn the right to be a grandma. You have to be a mom.
Which is difficult.
It is. It's a lot of hard work. It's and a I lot keep of hard telling work. Heather, because she's got her almost 2-year-old who's still nursing and very attached.
Yes.
I said, but Heather, when it's over forever. You'll never, ever have that time again. I woke Paul up from bed because we didn't think we could have.
But he was like 9 months old.
I know, but we didn't think we could have any more children.
He wasn't 2.
I know.
He couldn't ask you for it. He couldn't, I don't know.
He couldn't say, Mama doo-doo's, Mama doo-doo's. But see how fun grandchildren are? I mean, they're just the best.
I like that.
Reading good books. I've got one called The Christmas Chronicles, and I'm in a group with people on Facebook, and we're going to read this book starting the 1st of November, and it goes through January. And it's just ideas, recipes, stories that have to do with the Christmas holidays.
Awesome. Well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
It will be, but the book's real heavy, so I may have to put it on my iPad.
I have to do that with Kindles, or actually, I only read things on my phone through the library app, Libby. It's a
really?
Great thing. Yeah, I'll
have to see if they have that book then.
Yeah, I just wait. I'm waiting for the book that Paul suggested in his podcast. I just wait and I get it.
Oh, and I have that book. I've read that book. And yeah. I pulled it up. I've read 100% of that book, and I don't remember it because I read so much that I don't remember what I have read.
Yeah, my mom is a voracious reader. I discovered Kurt Vonnegut from just our bookshelves, and I'm trying to think of who else. Like all these very Aldous Huxley,
Hess,
like all these.
Herman
Hesse from that, and I just fell in love with all those books, and I felt very smart as a 15-year-old reading these books, these adult books. But yeah.
Or gardening.
Yeah.
Which you're even doing a little bit of that now.
Yeah, I am gardening. Yeah. It's nice. Lots of pulling weeds.
Yeah.
Everything grows here in Washington.
See, the good thing is your dad pulls weeds. I just get the fun part.
All right. Well, thank you, Mom, so much for being part
you
of
are welcome,
episode
Hezzy.
Number 4. After this, maybe I'll stop interviewing my family, but they are pretty interesting. And hey, listeners, if you've made it this far, I want to ask you a favor. If you could go over to Apple Podcasts and put a review and what you think of Mixed Identity, that would be super helpful. Again, if you have any thoughts of the episode that you just heard, you can check us out at Facebook at Identity Mixed or Instagram at Identity_Mixed. And I'd love to continue this conversation. Our theme music is Ice Flow by Kevin McLeod, licensed by Creative Commons. It can be found at filmmusic.io or incomtech.com.